MM Mobile, monitoring.
4RMM, KD2BNG.
Good to hear you. This is Kurt, and my wife and I are downtown, headed back from Pace Jewelers.
We repaired then. So hopefully you didn't pay a whole lot for that.
That their price is pretty reasonable for jewelry repair, and I don't know too many places, if any, that really perform jewelry repair other than these folks. Seems like everybody wants to say jewelry, but very few people will do on-site repair.
It's not something that just anyone can do with a soldering iron. I've tried it. It's not easy.
Deal with people that you know, and that they know you, and you're on a first name basis. These folks have been doing it for a very long time.
Yeah, they've been in that same part of West Greenville since, oh, I don't know, 1960, who knows?
That 60s or the 50s, they're a staple for sure. It's an experience. So we're headed back now, and we're at the intersection of Academy and being Wade Hampton. We're looking off to our right at the Bon Secours Arena.
I have a general idea. Jewelry repair is definitely a skill. I once tried making my my stepdaughter a little piece of jewelry. I had a Morgan dollar or a Peace dollar that I had, and I had some some jewelry foundations, and I just tried to make her a little pendant or necklace or something. Man, that came out awful. It takes more than just knowing how to work a soldering iron.
For at least trying. I'm just doing my first soldering as we speak, so I'm almost 50 years old. I've never soldered anything in my life until just recently.
Never really mastered. You need 60-40 lead solder, and you need a good iron, and keep the tip clean with like a little filing thing, or it's not an easy thing. It takes time to master.
Copy that. It's one of those things I just never even had to do, or in my normal course of living don't really need to do much other than whatever I want to put it off an antenna.
Do a little bit with circuit boards, mostly when mostly I was the software side of things. I didn't so much get involved with hardware design. But, yeah, if you build the occasional little circuit board or whatever, it's a good thing to know. Circuit board soldering is probably a little bit different than wire soldering. And as I said, 60-40 solder, nothing works better than lead.
Copy that. That and a good respirator, I would think.
Wouldn't worry about that, about that much, The only reason I think the electronics manufacturers had to stop using lead and solder, but it's still the best thing for hobbyist soldering. In other words, I could solder up a couple of boards for lead solder. I just couldn't produce boards, dozens or hundreds at a time, because it was an environmental thing. But I'll tell you a story about that. What I heard recently is that's the reason why a lot of electronics have a higher failure rate than they used to, because you get cold solder joints, and the, tin or whatever it is doesn't, I think it's tin, pure tin with a little tiny bit of copper, doesn't flow the same. And I also heard about the same thing about CFCs, which were used for cleaning circuit boards. After you draw the lines on them, you want to etch away. Some guy, this was 30 years ago, he was telling me he had to use this new circuit board cleaner that was CFC free, and nothing worked right after that. He had very high rate of a higher rate of failure is because now the solder doesn't stick properly because the new solvent didn't get the trace material completely off.
That certainly rings true with my experience as well, and you got the environmentalists getting in the way. You know, you can pretty much be assured that quality is going to suffer. I think our ancestors figured out what works, and then, you know, now it's all about saving the earth.
Had a third story about that. Computer manufacturer some years ago called Power Computing, a lot of CPU heatsink failures where the CPU would overheat because some environmentally friendly heatsink compound they had to use instead of whatever it was using before. So, I mean, yeah, you know, save the environment, but don't go overboard. It seems like between extreme environmentalism and business as usual, there should be some kind of middle path.
I wholeheartedly concur. It just seems like us folks in Western civilization aren't very good at finding that happy medium. We are eternally soldered to the pendulum, and we're going to go from one extreme to the other.
Electric cars, by 2030, 2040, thereabouts, I'm sure at some point the mandate is going to be for all electric cars. There the problem is, too, you need to roll out an infrastructure of either charging stations or battery swap stations. You know, I guess you pull the car over a pit, and this arm reaches out from below and grabs the battery and puts in a fresh battery. Because I guess the range is limited to, what, 200 miles or so, or 100 miles? Now, but I'll tell you what I thought was a good engineering compromise. If you remember a car about 10 years ago called the Chevy Volt, which was, it could go 50 or 60 miles on a charge, and then it had a gasoline-powered generator to recharge the batteries. Now, GM came up with that 50-mile figure, and also, of course, it plugs in. They came up with that 50-mile figure based on the fact that most people drive less than 50 miles a day. So the internal combustion engine generator thing was a range extender, which I thought was a good compromise between that and total electric.
Wife has a Toyota, a 2007 Toyota Prius, which we're still driving. It's still a joy. And if everybody wants to go full electric, it's clear from your remarks that we really haven't thought this through to the end as far as how to implement the infrastructure required to keep people running, whether it's through battery replacement or convenient, cost-effective recharge. We're just putting the cart before the horse once again.
Two approaches like the Tesla approach. Have a battery that's good for at least 200 miles and go all electric. Well, actually, who was it? Renault, I think. Was the one that came up with the battery swap station. I imagine something where the car drives over a pit and this hydraulic arm reaches up, unlatches the battery, grabs another battery, puts it in. And I guess there that's just a question of, you know, what's the universal design for the battery latch? We all have to agree on something. And that's the other thing. We don't even agree on what the charging plugs look like. There's three or four different EV charging plugs. So, not just infrastructure, but standardization. Which is why, as I said, the Volt was, I think, an engineering good compromise. You know, it was because it was electric with like generator backup. And yeah, you know, the Prius, 2007 Prius, you must have a good one. This one's a disaster. I got, like, electronic and computer problems with this one. But, yeah, the Prius is a good, the hybrid gasoline-electric drivetrain is a good approach, too. As I said, you know, I don't see, just as an engineer, it's a compromise. We're not going to achieve all electric, or all fuel cell, or all something, I don't know what. You're going to have petrol in the mix for a while, I think.
Glenn, until we figure out how to produce all of these batteries without the involvement of fossil fuels or the consumption of fossil fuels, you know, that's the bridge too far as I see things presently. I haven't studied any facts and figures as to what the net carbon effect is going to be to transition internal combustion, every civilian internal combustion vehicle to a fully electric vehicle. But the elephant in the room is, how are they going to produce all the electricity required? Is it going to be nuclear, or are they going to do this through hydroelectricity?
Above, there was a energy department, whatever department it is, there was actually a ruling recently that was good in that favor, that would allow more dams and streams to be dammed up to make hydro. And let's see, you know, there's a few things that are moving in the right direction. Solar has finally gotten to the break-even point, where solar used to be $6-$7 or so a watt, and I always said when it gets below $2-$3 a watt, less than $2 a watt, you're going to see a breakout, which probably 3 to 5 years ago we started to see. All of a sudden I see every rooftop covered in solar electric panels. So that's going in the right direction. Some of it's regulatory, some of it's research and development. Nuclear, you know, the lead time for a nuclear plant is, if you wanted nuclear plants now, you had to build them 30 years ago, because that's about how long it takes to get all through all the regulatory and construction process. So I don't know if nuclear is going to change the balance quickly in the short run.
Sure, I agree. I think that's unfortunate, considering the fact that I live within 17 linear miles of a nuclear reactor in Oconee, and I have done so since 1975 without so much as a hiccup. And I think it's France that has either 80% or close to 100% of its energy needs supplied by nuclear means. And if you need any further convincing as to the modern-day safety of nuclear infrastructure, you can just look at Newport News Shipyard and count how many nuclear reactors are active and present, concentrated in that harbor at any given time.
I'm guessing one per submarine, probably three or four, four of them for a battleship or an aircraft carrier. You might have 50 reactors at any given time in that one location. Let's see, if you had a dozen submarines, a carrier, I don't know about 50, but quite a few. And yeah, Lake Oconee, you know, one of the cleanest white lakes that I've seen. If it was sitting next to a fossil fuel plant, maybe not so much.
You know, and you mentioned that they're contemplating, reworking their water management at the dam on 4th Street. I think if you were to run that idea past a convention of environmentalists, you'd probably get a lot of heads exploding at the mere suggestion of doing that.
The sort of brain that absorbs random crap. So don't ask me where I read that. but there was somewhere on the order of 8,000 smaller rivers and streams that could be dammed if the water rights, the water usage laws were relaxed a bit. There's another 8,000 usable rivers and tributaries. And the environmentalists, you know what's funny too though, how the anti-nuclear movement and the environmentalist movement overlap. Think about that, and think if there's any real logic to that. The anti-nuclear environmentalists, well, yeah, I guess burning a million pounds of coal is the better thing.
We want to find a very tight niche. I think you've just described it.
Am I wrong? You have a lot of people in the... If you do a Venn diagram of the anti-nuclear people and some of the more proactive environmentalist people, I think there's a big overlap there. The environmentalists should be the first to say, well, let's see. We don't really have any air pollution. We don't have any water pollution other than some heating of the outer water loop. And that, you know, that it does, it raises the temperature of a lake maybe half a degree. It does produce some nuclear waste that's in the hundreds or thousands of pounds instead of the millions and millions of pounds. And it's usually pretty easy to deal with. You know, find a big, seal it in concrete and dump it in a salt mine. So, yeah, it surprises me that those two have that much overlap.
They could do a better job of milking the fear specter about nuclear power. I mean, we've been doing this thing for 80 years now. Other than a few Soviet naval mishaps, and of course you had Chernobyl, but everybody will. And then what happened to Fukushima? You know, a few, you know, 10 or 15 or so years ago. Other than those things, so Three Mile Island, but I don't think anybody died. There was zero fatalities with Three Mile Island. If you add all those incidents together, I think we have a pretty handsome safety record. But you know, facts and politics and policy can be very strange bedfellows.
Fukushima reactor and the Three Mile Island reactor, like pretty much all the Western reactors, are either light water or heavy water moderated. Which actually means if the same thing is both coolant and moderator, then when you lose coolant, you actually kill the reaction. Chernobyl was graphite moderated. So when you lost containment, you had a fire, a really, 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 really big one. You know, how many pounds of burning graphite? And then you also had bits of fuel getting vaporized, you know, bits of plutonium and then uranium getting vaporized in the smoke, fission products getting vaporized in the smoke, generally nasty. So I would, you know, different level of disaster.
Indeed, the Chernobyl situation was entirely preventable from the documentaries I've seen on it. They were playing pretty fast and loose with the tests they were conducting. The Fukushima reactor in Japan, I believe, was 2 weeks away from being turned off or taken offline.
Combination of, there was a tsunami, if you recall, which had something to do with knocking out the power for the pumps for the cooling system. And that's another thing. Why not just make the cooling system a water tower? Gravity pretty much always works. But I think that was the reason for the Fukushima disaster. Not really that big a disaster, but, what they call an event. An event. So that event happened, I think, because you lost the generators that were making electricity for the coolant pumps. 3 Mile Island. Now, in either case, you might have had some radioactive vapor or some radioactive water or something get out, but, you know, radioactive water vapor, radioactive, but nothing compared to what happened in Chernobyl. You know, again, different reactor design. Pressurized water or boiling water reactor design versus graphite design.
That's quite an education for me. It's a deep dive into some of the technical aspects there. I think you're more on top of this issue than I am, but just from what I've read, seen, and experienced in my life, I'm pretty comfortable with nuclear, especially since we're 80 years into our relationship with nuclear power. I don't think anybody does it better than us here in the United States.
One of really those one or two events that people remember, they made a big deal over the 3 Mile Island event. Funny thing, not more than a year or two before that, you had a motion picture, which actually had a similar type of accident. Some film, you remember a film called The China Syndrome? That film was a year or two before that. So the confluence of those two, of life imitating art, I think is what put people off nuclear power. There was some accident in the 1950s, maybe, in the UK, involving some other reactor. I think, again, some sort of graphite reactor, which is really no longer used, that released fission products or something, probably fission products. Other than that, I can't remember a whole hell of a lot of them.
The reason for that is that there aren't a lot of them, and, you know, Hollywood will, they primed the psychology for people to react, you know, just in time for 3 Mile Island. There again, I think, you know, it's the 800-pound elephant in the room. Everybody knows that it's safe, even its opponents know that it's safe and effective, but it just doesn't fit into the political narrative for them to consider that. It's kind of like natural immunity. That's the category it's been put in.
Natural immunity until you die. Well, I'm not going to comment on that to the anti-vaxxers that might be listening, because that may cause an argument. But yeah, it might be too late. France, as you said, gets, last I heard, more than 60%, possibly as much as 80% of their power from nuclear fission. Probably too late in this country to build out a lot more fission plants in the near term. So you're dealing with wind and solar and hydro, you know, unless somebody figures out thermonuclear fusion. What's the old physics joke? Fusion is the power of the future and always will be.
Well, that's why we're here and what the trees and plants depend on, certainly. Glenn, I enjoyed our QSO and I enjoyed our conversation. I am Cubby 73 here. I just pulled into the garage. Again, I appreciate some of the thought-provoking things that you brought up. And obviously, you're on top of a lot of this subject matter.
I just used to read a lot of issues of Popular Science when it was still around. But yeah, it's always been interesting. Anyway, Kurt, I'll let you go. I'm sitting here somewhere, so I guess I'm supposed to go inside and do something and finish my errands for the day and go home. So you take care, 73s. This is KD2BNG.
Glenn, I'll be 73. This is KO4RMN.
Alaska X Mobile.
56IW Mobile.
Hey, this is Patrick on this end.
Nice to meet you. My name is Jeff. I'm in Greenville, kind of near Elm Road and Hayward Road. My call is AC6IW.
XRW, is that correct?
India Whiskey, IW.
Roger that. K6IW.
Charlie 6, like alternating current, AC6IW.
How doing today? Just moving around or running errands?
Running errands. I've got a 16-year-old daughter that I'm picking up from her mom's and driving her out to Malden for ballet. She does lots of ballet. And she drives, but she doesn't have a car of her own right now, so I'm doing that.
Yeah, I remember those days of having to pick mine up and take it everywhere. He was a handful with everything going on.
And what are you up to?
My son is 22 now, and I am heading up 25 into North Carolina so I can go pick up a tool cart that I have at FedEx in there at the Asheville Airport. I live in Brevard. I run a mobile tool route down here in Greenville.
Do you drive between Greenville and Charlotte sometimes? I think I spoke to you once before late at night.
I do not go to Charlotte. I go to Brevard, North Carolina. Probably wasn't me you were talking to then, but I am out late at night usually. I'm just cutting the day short so I can go get this tool cart.
Yeah, there was some guy that I spoke with before that maybe like 11 o'clock or midnight, and he ran some kind of a tool business that he just bought in a new truck, and he was talking about how the, you know, supply chain stuff and the shortages on things and the challenges of doing that. So is that changing any for you with the supply chain stuff, or is it kind of bad for tools?
It's kind of bad. We're having a hard time getting pretty much anything anymore, it seems like. Wait for a screwdriver for months or a socket to replace it when it's broken. So everybody's kind of unhappy about it, but there's nothing we can do about it.
You can still give Patrick a hard time, though. KP4CVA.
Neighborhood, Dave.
I just thought I'd jump in there and say hello.
And I'm sure you're going to play tennis or just coming back from it.
Headed to 3 hours of tennis, so looking forward to it.
So how long you had your license?
Originally from California, that's why I've got the 6 call, and I need to look it up, but I think I was first licensed around 1980 or 1981, somewhere like that, and then moved here in 97 and had kind of been out of ham radio from about 2000 until just maybe 3 months ago. Got back into it and got myself, I come on an FT5D Yaesu handy talkie, and then I have a Yaesu FT991A at home, so I love it. It's a cool hobby. I'm glad to be back into it.
I know. I got the 991A also, and I got my technician ticket about a year ago, but I just upgraded my general, a week and a half ago, I believe it was.
So, have you been on HF? I mean, I think that's, for me, HF is lots of fun. I like that part of it. And I love the 991A. It's so cool. I've got it all hooked up to my, I've got a MacBook Pro. So I've got, you know, the logging program and all the different things that did. None of that stuff existed when I was licensed in radio. That's lots of cool things.
Push to that, you're starting to break up a little bit. But I haven't been on HF much since I got my general ticket, a little bit, but not a whole lot. And I'm still working on getting all the logging software and the radio hooked up to the computer so that I can do all that stuff.
Are you on a Mac or a PC? Instagram is like the best one out there for PC. I've got a friend of mine that he's a new general, and he's trying to get his 991A set up with all the different things. But since I'm on a Mac, I can't really say from experience what I think of any of the other software.
It's all new to me still, so I really don't know what to recommend. But Dave here, he might be able to recommend something.
Nice to meet you, Dave. This is Jeff, AC6IW.
I recommend that you talk to somebody that knows what they're talking about. I guess you're talking about, you know, the FT8 software and FT4. I used to know the call, I've downloaded the software on my PC, on my laptop, and, I started with, you know, you gotta set it up, and I started going through the setup, and I got to the second page, I think, or whatever you call it, and it started asking questions that I didn't know the answer to, and I couldn't find it in my manual for my radio, so I just stopped there, and and that's where I've been, so I'm sure there's somebody listening that can point you in the right direction.
Comment. Yeah, this is KN4TZW. Name's Gabriel. I'm out in Hendersonville. I believe the software you're referring to is WSJTX. That's the most popular one that covers all those digital modes.
I knew it had a W and a J in it, but I couldn't remember the rest of it.
WSJTX. Whatever, I have that one. And then the thing that I have that controls the radio and does the logging, and since I'm on a Mac, it's called Mac DX Logger. And it's cool because it'll show like the cluster, DX cluster stuff, and you can kind of see what's happening. But I need to finish setting it all up so it logs what I log on my computer up to that, what they call it, logbook of the world. So it's, I know what you mean. You sit there and you read stuff, and sometimes, like for me, I'll do some of it and I'll take a break, come back, do some more of it. AC6IW.
HTX. Guys, I'm going to have to say 7-3s. I'm getting ready to cross the state line, so I'll start losing you. KO4 HTX, and I'll be clear on your finals. 7-3s, guys.
KO4 HTX, I think. This is AC6IW.
7-3s, Patrick. You have a good evening. KB4 CPA. Jeff, are you just getting back into the hobby, I think I heard you say?
It's only been about 3 months now since I've been back into the hobby. But yeah, I mean, I never worked very much in the digital remote stuff, so I've got that program you mentioned, and I've done the FT8 on it a little bit, or I just leave it going so I can kind of see where people are showing up from, and then I like the logging feature of the software that I use, where I just, dial, or, you know, turn the dial to whatever I'm listening to and punch in a call, and then when I'm done, just hit log. It's so much easier than using paper.
The FT8, go to somebody's house and see them on FT8. What it's all about, and it's not like getting on sideband and talking. You don't really have a extended QSO, and it's just making contacts basically.
Yeah, that's kind of my thing. That's why I like hanging out on sideband. When I was in it before, I used to hang out on 75 meters and talk to a group of people back in the 90s before there was, like, the internet and all that. So I kind of like that aspect of the ham radio stuff. So the FT8 thing, I mean, it's interesting, but it's kind of boring. But it's just interesting to see where I can make a contact from and then maybe try to switch over to single sideband and use that.
HF when it was open, and now you go to FT8. FT8 is like shooting fish in a barrel. It's something to do.
I'm not liking it at all. It's just another mode of operation, and it's just one that I don't do. heck, who knows? I may get into it later on. I'm mostly on sideband right now, and I'm all over the place from 15 to 80 meters. It just wherever the action is.
If you do happen to get into it, I think it's EQ 100 or something like that. I've got a program. I'd have to look it up. But you can go in there and it shows you the contacts you made, and you can get a printable QSL card on paper. I've made up sheets with four boxes on, and when I get the X contacts, I acknowledge them and then I paste them. And I got like a leaflet book with the long distance contacts. But it's not much fun. You put it on to make a contact. I run two computers. So you go to your other computer, you're doing something. All of a sudden it comes up and says you made a contact. You log it. And then you go back. You put another one on and go back to the computer. Just like shooting fish in a barrel. But with the band conditions being so bad, not much else to do. K2SST.
Well, good deal. Like I said, I just hang out mostly on voice, on sideband, and Jeff, let me, if you're able to get on 80 meters, let me invite you to check into the net every night on 80 meters 39:15, 7 o'clock. Anybody can check in, so we'd be glad to have you along.
I think I've heard that net before, and I just haven't tried to make contact with it, but I'll remember that 39:15 at 7 p.m. Whereabouts are you located? And my setup for the antenna is a little bit less than what I've had in the past. I've got a 40-meter full-wave loop in the attic, and then I've got a 268-foot infed that's out in the backyard that's kind of through the trees. That actually works really good. So, and anyway, I'll try to check on 39:15. That'll be fun.
I have a Carolina Wyndham in the backyard in the trees, and it's 80 through 6 meters, and it does not do 160. It's not the long Wyndham, it's the short one. And I heard some people on 180 last night, I think it was. I tried to talk to them, but they couldn't. They couldn't get me, so they heard me, but they couldn't, they just couldn't understand what I was saying. But I had a good, strong signal on them, so I thought I'd give it a try, even though the antenna's not designed to transmit on that frequency.
AC6IW.
And the spot, yeah, stop. Okay. Make sure I'm bringing the repeater up. Because there's some dead spots right here. I'm at Statewood and Congaree, and I'm going to the sports club on Congaree, so I'm almost there. I'm located in Taylor's, and in the Pheasant Ridge subdivision.
Well, I'm actually probably pretty close to you right now at your tennis location. I'm on 385, just passing Roper Mountain Road, so not too far from you.
Got you full quieting on the input frequency on the repeater, so yep, you just went past me. I guess you're going, are you going north or south?
I'm going out to Malden. My daughter takes ballet out there, like near, Butler Road and Lawrence Road, that area.
I just went past me. When you went under the Patewood Bridge, that's where I was sitting. Yeah. So we could talk simplex probably for a few miles until you get on down the road. I'm sitting at a light right now, and it's kind of a long light. When it turns red, it stays red for a long time.
I go through that intersection too. So you play lots of tennis. Do you? What got you into that? And do you coach it, or just, are you on an adult league, or what?
I've been playing since on and off since I was a teenager, but seriously playing just the last probably 2 or 3 years since I've been a member of the sports club here. We played, a friend of mine and I played 2 or 3 days a week, and maybe like 2 days a week and 1 day on the weekend. But then I joined the sports club here, and there's a lot more opportunities to play. I play a lot more doubles here. I used to play singles all the time, and I played on hard court. And here they have a lot of clay courts, and most of the guys want to play on clay, and it is, better for your joints and everything. And I'm not getting any younger, so I'm 66, so I need that little cushion. But I will play on a hard court if I have to. There's some hard courts here too.
That's pretty cool. So are you, I forgot if you said, how long have you been a ham?
Kid in 1982. That was my novice. This is my novice call. I've kept it the whole time. I just like it, and I really don't want to change. So, but if I ever get my extra, I don't know, I may change my call. Because it is rather long, and a 2x3, and it would be better to have a shorter call, especially, if you're doing any DX stuff. I remember when the N4 calls came out, everybody said, oh, you need to get your N4 call, and I didn't see what the big deal was, but I do now. So, live and learn. But anyway, there may be a call out there for me. When I get ready to change, who knows?
Call again? I really didn't even remember getting it. Mine is AC6IW.
XIW, okay. Well, see, that's, what is that? A 2x2. So, that's not a bad call for 1982.
So are you general or advanced or what?
General class. I've taken. I've sat in the class for the extra that Gary and Dave and Tom teach, and but I just I'm just having a hard time with it, was having a hard time with it. I've kind of set it off to the side right now, but anyway, didn't go through the class, never took the test because I was taking practice tests online, and they were the same thing that you would get, you know, if you went and actually took it, and and I couldn't get a decent enough score to pass, so there's no use wasting my money going and taking the test. So anyway, I'll get there one of these days.
I kind of did the similar sort of thing. Like I was saying before, I need to look to see when I was first licensed. I know it was somewhere around between 80 and 82, somewhere in that area. I kept my novice call sign for all the time until I got my, my plan was to not get a new call until I got my extra, and that's what I did, but I got up to advanced, and then I went to college, and I couldn't get my code to 20 words per minute. I was stuck around 18, and then finally, after I completed college, I got back into ham radio again, and got my code up to, actually, up about 25 or 30 words a minute, passed the test, and then got a new call, and I was hoping I'd get, like, a shorter call, you know, like one by two or something like that, but when I got the AC6IW, I was like, okay, I guess I'll stick with that, but I was kind of hoping I'd get an even shorter call, but I guess they just didn't have those to give out at that time or whatever. But I like my call.
I mean, it's a decent call. I mean, you know, hang on to it. I don't think it's a bad call at all. Well, I'm going to jump out of here. I'm sitting in the parking place, and I'm hoping I can warm my knees up just a tiny bit. I got a game that's starting at 4:30, and so I need to get in there and get these knees warmed up just a little bit before I get out on the court, because I'll be wore out by the time I finish playing 3 hours straight. But good to talk to you, and be careful going down 385 there. 73's Jeff, and we'll talk to you later. Stick around for your final, KV4CPA.
With you too. I'm almost to my destination. 73's KV4CBA. This is AC6IW. I'll look for you some other time. Nice talking.